tuned to Melbourne Radio Southern FM, where you hear nothing but great music. 88.3 Southern FM.
And on this evening, we're going to have a very, very special space show. More about that after our theme music, which is Motion of Stars by Vangelis. Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and on this evening's Space Show, we have got something very, very special. Here's a little teaser for it.
Only if the United States occupies a position of preeminence can we help decide whether this new ocean will be a sea of peace or a new terrifying theater of war. But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Yes, it's 50 years ago that President Kennedy from America delivered the speech at Rice University in Texas. Now, you will have heard one part of that speech dozens of possibly even hundreds of times, but have you ever heard the full speech? And why was it so significant? This evening, we have both the full speech and the explanation of its context, plus some of the other things that Kennedy said.
Each year across Australia in community radio stations like ours, more than 5,000 volunteer broadcasters are provided with media skills training. Skills used in broadcasting, but also in people's work and communities. This training and experience has been the beginning of many paid media careers. This training means that community broadcasters can share with you a passion for music, local affairs, a language, culture, a cause, a community.
Tell your local politicians about the importance of your local community station. Community broadcasting, our voices, our vision.
Spoken by Anthony Boxshaw and Tracy Hutchinson. Authorised by John Martin, 144 George Street, Fitzroy.
You're listening to The Space Show with Andrew Rennie. In 1945, the United States emerged victorious over the militaristic Japanese and the German Nazis. Its major allies in the Second World War lay in ruins. The following decade saw Europe divided into two camps with opposing social systems. The term Cold War was coined. The United States and Soviet Union were in a race for supremacy. When, in 1957, the Soviets were the first to place a satellite into orbit around the Earth, the United States was shocked to the core.
The Soviet Union has launched the world's first artificial satellite as part of International Geophysical Year research. The United States scientists attending an IGY conference in Washington have acclaimed the Soviet feat as opening a new era in science. The satellite is now approaching the Earth every 95 minutes. It's traveling at a speed of 18,000 miles an hour in an elliptical orbit, about 560 miles from the Earth at its furthest point. The satellite was launched by a carrier rocket from an undisclosed point in the Soviet Union. It weighs 184 pounds and is 22 inches in diameter. It has two radio transmitters sending signals in the 15 and 7.5 meter bands.
Outraged Americans couldn't understand how a nation that had been largely reduced to rubble in 1945 could, only 12 years later, have beaten them into space. They demanded action from the Eisenhower administration. The response was seen by many to be insufficient, with failures like this one in 1957 December. NASA was formed in 1959, and it began a program to launch satellites. Some of these satellites would carry humans. Seven astronauts were selected as part of Project Mercury. In 1960, the Democrat John Kennedy was elected over the Republican Richard Nixon. A wave of optimism swept the country, but soon problems beset the Kennedy administration. He approved the Eisenhower plan to invade Cuba. That invasion was a fiasco. Then, in 1961 April, the Soviet Union launched Vostok 1. Aboard was Yuri Gagarin. America had been beaten in the race to put a human into space.
This is the BBC Home Service. Here is the news. All Moscow is waiting to give a hero's welcome to the world's first spaceman, Major Gagarin of the Soviet Air Force. Major Gagarin was sent up in his 4.5-ton spaceship from somewhere in the Soviet Union. As he looked down on the Earth from the loneliness of space, he streaked across Asia, Africa, and South America, controlling the pitch and roll of the ship.
3 weeks later, NASA was ready. Alan Shepard was lofted on a suborbital flight that barely made it into space. Gagarin had made a full orbit of the planet.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Ignition.
Ignition.
We can see the ignition. The rocket's beginning to rise, agonizingly slowly. The astronaut has turned on his clock, and here we go. We're on our way into space with Alan B. Shepard. I'll join you in just a second on another microphone. It's rising slowly, oh, painfully slowly, and it looks so terribly lonesome with a little red spot on the tail. But it's going steadily and true, and now the sound is reaching us. I hope you can hear it.
The Soviets were clearly ahead of America in space achievement. Kennedy had to do something. It had to be bold, and it had to be dramatic. Many options were considered, including investing in cancer research. Only one thing stood out as sure to win the Cold War propaganda campaign, an enterprise in which the Kennedy administration felt America could outspend the Soviet Union, an endeavor in which America would leverage its technological advantage over the Soviet Union, an achievement that would forever place American capitalist achievement in the history books. And so, on May the 25th, just 20 days after America's first feeble suborbital spaceflight, Kennedy stood before a joint session of Congress. In a strong and inspiring voice, he threw down the challenge.
I believe we should go to the moon. I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish.
This challenge Kennedy had laid down was more to Congress and the American taxpayer than to the Soviet Union. A moon trip was going to be very expensive, and without congressional support, it would never happen. Congress responded by giving NASA the money it needed to get started on the project. In Texas, the home state of space-supporting Vice President Lyndon Johnson, a new space center was being built. A forlorn patch of coastal prairie was being converted into the site of NASA's new manned spacecraft center. By the time the center was due to be opened, there was mounting opposition to this hugely expensive enterprise. Already the space budget had increased to 40 cents per week for every man, woman, and child in the United States. This was more than the allocations of the previous 8 years combined. Soon it would be more than 50 cents. This at a time when you could buy an ice cream for 1 cent and newspapers cost less than 5 cents. Kennedy drafted and redrafted a speech in support of the Apollo Moon program. On 1962, September the 12th, he travelled to Rice University on the outskirts of Houston. The notional purpose was to help dedicate the new manned spacecraft center, some 34 kilometers from Rice. The real purpose was to shore up support for his vision of beating the Soviets to the moon. If Congress did not continue to fund Apollo, then one of the linchpins of the Kennedy presidency would have failed. Perhaps Kennedy would not be able to win a second presidential term in the 1964 elections. And so, in a sparsely populated stadium, invited dignitaries sat in the humid air under the hot Texas sun. They sat quietly in the heat, fanning themselves and mopping their brows. Kennedy arrived, mounted the podium set out on the football field, and began the speech that was designed to inspire Americans to reach for the moon. For almost 18 minutes, he laid out the staggering costs of the venture. He did not deny the technological hurdles that would have to be cleared to build the Apollo spacecraft and its giant Saturn booster. He described some of the benefits of the project, but had the courage to admit that most of the benefits remained unknown. During those 18 minutes, now firmly established in history, Kennedy gradually worked his audience to a fever pitch. As you will hear, he ends to rapturous applause. Here then is that speech in full, delivered 50 years ago today. And by the way, this is quite possibly the first time this speech has ever been broadcast in full on Australian radio.
President Tipton, Mr. Vice President, Governor, Congressman Thomas, Senator Wiley and Congressman Miller, Mr. Webb, Mr. Bell, scientists, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate your president having made me an honorary visiting professor, and I will assure you that my first lecture will be very brief. I am delighted to be here, and I'm particularly delighted to be here on this occasion. We meet at a college noted for knowledge, in a city noted for progress, in a state noted for strength, and we stand in need of all three. For we meet in an hour of change and challenge, in a decade of hope and fear, in an age of both knowledge and ignorance. The greater our knowledge increases, the greater our ignorance unfolds. Despite the striking fact that most of the scientists that the world has ever known are alive and working today, despite the fact that this nation's own scientific manpower is doubling every 12 years in a rate of growth more than three times that of our population as a whole, despite that, the vast stretches of the unknown and the unanswered and the unfinished still far outstrip our collective comprehension. No man can fully grasp how far and how fast we have come. But condense, if you will, the 50,000 years of man's recorded history in a time span of but a half a century. Stated in these terms, we know very little about the first 40 years, except at the end of them, advanced man had learned to use the skins of animals to cover them. Then about 10 years ago, under this standard, man emerged from his caves to construct other kinds of shelter. Only 5 years ago, man learned to write and use a cart with wheels. Christianity began less than 2 years ago. The printing press came this year. And then less than 2 months ago, during this whole 50-year span of human history, the steam engine provided a new source of power. Newton explored the meaning of gravity. Last month, electric light and telephones and automobiles and airplanes became available. Only last week did we develop penicillin and television and nuclear power. And now, if America's new spacecraft succeeds in reaching Venus, we will have literally reached the stars before midnight tonight. This is a breathtaking pace, and such a pace cannot help but create new ills as it dispels old. New ignorance, new problems, new dangers. Surely the opening vistas of space promise high costs and hardships, as well as high reward. So it is not surprising that some would have us stay where we are a little longer, to rest, to wait. But this city of Houston, this state of Texas, this country of the United States was not built by those who waited and rested and wished to look behind them. This country was conquered by those who move forward, and so will space. William Bradford, speaking in 1630 of the founding of the Plymouth Bay Colony, said that all great and honorable actions are accompanied with great difficulties, and both must be enterprised and overcome with answerable courage. If this capsule history of our progress teaches us anything, it is that man in his quest for knowledge and progress is determined and cannot be deterred. The exploration of space will go ahead, whether we join in it or not. And it is one of the great adventures of all time. And no nation which expects to be the leader of other nations can expect to stay behind in this race for space. Those who came before us made certain that this country rode the first waves of the Industrial Revolution, the first waves of modern invention, and the first wave of nuclear power. And this generation does not intend to founder in the backwash of the coming age of space. We mean to be a part of it. We mean to lead it. For the eyes of the world now look into space, to the moon and to the planets beyond. And we have vowed that we shall not see it governed by a hostile flag of conquest, but by a banner of freedom and peace. We have vowed that we shall not see space filled with weapons of mass destruction, but with instruments of knowledge and understanding. Yet the vows of this nation can only be fulfilled if we in this nation are first, and therefore we intend to be first. In short, our leadership in science and industry, our hopes for peace and security, our obligations to ourselves as well as others, all require us to make this effort to solve these mysteries, to solve them for the good of all men, and to become the world's leading space-faring nation. We set sail on this new sea because there is new knowledge to be gained and new rights to be won, and they must be won and used for the progress of all people. For space science, like nuclear science and all technology, has no conscience of its own. Whether it will become a force for good or ill depends on man. And only if the United States occupies a position of preeminence can we help decide whether this new ocean will be a sea of peace or a new terrifying theater of war. I do not say that we should or will go unprotected against the hostile misuse of space, any more than we go unprotected against the hostile use of land or sea. But I do say that space can be explored and mastered without feeding the fires of war, without repeating the mistakes that man has made in extending his writ around this globe of ours. There is no strife, no prejudice, no national conflict in outer space as yet. Its hazards are hostile to us all. Its conquest deserves the best of all mankind. And its opportunity for peaceful cooperation may never come again. But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too. It is for these reasons that I regard the decision last year to shift our efforts in space from low to high gear as among the most important decisions that will be made during my incumbency in the office of the presidency. In the last 24 hours, we have seen facilities now being created for the greatest and most complex exploration in man's history. We have felt the ground shake and the air shattered by the testing of a Saturn C-1 booster rocket, many times as powerful as the Atlas which launched John Glenn, generating power equivalent to 10,000 automobiles with their accelerator on the floor. We have seen the site where five F-1 rocket engines, each one as powerful as all engines of the Saturn combined, would be clustered together to make the advanced Saturn missile, assembled in a new building to be built at Cape Canaveral, as tall as a 48-story structure, as wide as a city block, and as long as two lengths of this field. Within these last 19 months, at least 45 satellites have circled the Earth. Some 40 of them were made in the United States of America. And they were far more sophisticated and supplied far more knowledge to the people of the world than those of the Soviet Union. The Mariner spacecraft... The Mariner spacecraft, now on its way to Venus, is the most intricate instrument in the history of space science. The accuracy of that shot is comparable to firing a missile from Cape Canaveral and dropping it in this stadium between the 40-yard lines. Transit satellites are helping our ships at sea to steer a safer course. Tyrus satellites have given us unprecedented warnings of hurricanes and storms, and will do the same for forest fires and icebergs. We have had our failures, but so have others, even if they do not admit them, and they may be less public. To be sure, we are behind, and will be behind for some time in manned flight. But we do not intend to stay behind, and in this decade, we shall make up and move ahead. The growth of our science and education will be enriched by new knowledge of our universe and environment, by new techniques of learning and mapping and observation, by new tools and computers for industry, medicine, and the home as well as the school. Technical institutions such as Rice will reap the harvest of these gains. And finally, the space effort itself, while still in its infancy, has already created a great number of new companies and tens and thousands of new jobs. Space and related industries are generating new demands in investment and skilled personnel. And this city and this state and this region will share greatly in this growth. What was once the furthest outpost on the old frontier of the West will be the furthest outpost on the new frontier of science and space. Houston, your city of Houston, with its manned spacecraft center, will become the heart of a large scientific and engineering community. During the next 5 years, the National Aeronautic and Space Administration expects to double the number of scientists and engineers in this area, to increase its outlays for salaries and expenses to $60 million a year, to invest some $200 million in plant and laboratory facilities, and to direct or contract for new space efforts over $1 billion from this center in this city. To be sure, all this costs us all a good deal of money. This year's space budget is three times what it was in January 1961, and it is greater than the space budget of the previous 8 years combined. That budget now stands at $5.4 billion a year, a staggering sum, though somewhat less than we pay for cigarettes and cigars every year. Space expenditures will soon rise some more, from 40 cents per person per week to more than 50 cents a week for every man, woman, and child in the United States. For we have given this program a high national priority, even though I realize that this is, in some measure, an act of faith and vision. For we do not now know what benefits await us. But if I were to say, my fellow citizens, that we shall send to the moon, 240,000 miles away from the control station in Houston, a giant rocket more than 300 feet tall, the length of this football field, made of new metal alloys, some of which have not yet been invented, capable of standing heat and stresses several times more than have ever been experienced, fitted together with a precision better than the finest watch, carrying all the equipment needed for propulsion, guidance, control, communications, food, and survival on an untried mission to an unknown celestial body, and then return it safely to Earth, re-entering the atmosphere at speeds of over 25,000 miles per hour, causing heat about half that on the temperature of the sun, almost as hot as it is here today, and do all this, and do it right, and do it first. Before this decade is out, then we must be bold. I'm the one who's doing all the work, so we just want you to stay cool for a minute. However, I think we're going to do it. And I think that we must pay what needs to be paid. I don't think we ought to waste any money, but I think we ought to do the job. And this will be done in the decade of the 60s. It may be done while some of you are still here at school at this college and university. It will be done during the terms of office of some of the people who sit here on this platform. But it will be done, and it will be done before the end of this decade. And I am delighted that this university is playing a part in putting a man on the moon as part of a great national effort of the United States of America. Years ago, the great British explorer George Mallory, who was to die on Mount Everest, was asked why did he want to climb it. He said, because it is there. Well, space is there, and we're going to climb it. And the moon and the planets are there, and new hopes for knowledge and peace are there. And therefore, as we set sail, we ask God's blessing on the most hazardous and dangerous and greatest adventure on which man has ever embarked. Thank you.
President Kennedy speaking 50 years ago today in support of the Apollo manned lunar landing program. And we have more about Kennedy and his speeches after this message.
My dad's a blood cancer scientist. He says researchers need more money to find cures for leukemia, lymphoma and myeloma. And he says you can help by hosting a Light the Night walk for the Leukemia Foundation this September. Big or small, it will look amazing when everyone joins in and shines gold, white and blue lanterns of hope. To find out how you can help your town to shine, visit lightthenight.org.au.
Reaching into your community, the Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
Well, you're listening to The Space Show, and on this evening's program, we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of that speech at Rice University by President Kennedy. But we have more about that speech and the consequences and other things he did, as well as another speech you've probably never heard. So what happened then was that Congress continued to support the program, although during 1963 more and more reservations were being expressed as to whether the endeavor was worthwhile. Behind the scenes, Vice President Johnson worked solidly to see the project forward. On 1962, November the 21st, Kennedy held a 73-minute meeting in the White House with many NASA and government officials. This meeting was tape recorded, which is fortunate as it gives an insight into presidential decision making. During the meeting, Kennedy made clear his administration's priority that the United States land on the moon before the Soviet Union. Faced with the option of directing federal funds more generally across the entire space program, President Kennedy argued for a more focused approach toward the lunar landing. NASA Administrator James Webb argued for other space goals in addition to Apollo. Kennedy argued that the moon goal would carry the entire country's space effort forward and have the same outcome as Webb was seeking. The meeting discussed a supplemental budget for NASA and the effect that would have on manned orbital flights and landings on the moon. At that time, a lunar landing was scheduled for 1967. Kennedy wanted a landing earlier, but Webb and his deputy, Robert Siemens, explained to the president that the timetable could not be expedited. In an animated exchange, Webb fearlessly disagreed with Kennedy's priorities. But Kennedy insisted that the moon landing was the priority program, not only for NASA, but for the entire government. The desired outcome, said Kennedy, was that the United States would beat the Soviets to the moon. The ultimate outcome of this pivotal meeting was both a win and a loss for both Kennedy and Webb. Kennedy managed to keep the moon landing as top priority for NASA. Webb got Kennedy to realize that the moon landing was not going to happen before 1967. That date, if maintained, would still lie within Kennedy's presidency if he were re-elected in 1964. On 1963, July 29, President Kennedy wrote a memorandum to Vice President Johnson asking two questions. The first question was whether the administration had a moon program before Kennedy's message to Congress in 1961 May. The second asked about military spacecraft from the Apollo space program. Upon receipt of this query, Johnson consulted the Space Council. On July 31, Johnson wrote back that there was no NASA moon program until Kennedy's message to Congress. He noted that the previous administration undertook studies on this question, but no commitment for hardware, facilities, or schedule was made. Johnson answered Kennedy's second question by noting that it was not possible to ascribe quantitative measure to the spin-offs from the non-military portion of the space program. Johnson added that there were both direct and indirect value from the scientific and engineering ability. He went on to list some of those benefits. He concluded, "The space program is expensive, but it can be justified as a solid investment which will give ample returns in security, prestige, knowledge, and material benefits," end quote. Kennedy used this reply to help draft a speech he was to deliver on 1963, November the 23rd. This speech was crafted to shore up public support for the moon program by justifying it as being of military use. On November the 21st of 1963, Kennedy was at the Brooks Air Force Base, and he made these remarks at the dedication of the Aerospace Medical Health center at, as I said, at Brooks Air Force Base.
The President's remarks at the dedication of the Aerospace Medical Health Center from Brooks Air Force Base, Texas, November 21st, 1963.
Thank you. Mr. Secretary, Governor, Mr. Vice President, Senator, members of the Congress, members of the military, ladies and gentlemen, for more than 3 years, I've spoken about the new frontier. This is not a partisan term, and it's not the exclusive property of Republicans or Democrats. It refers instead to this nation's place in history, to the fact that we do stand on the edge of a great new era, filled with both crisis and opportunity, an era to be characterized by achievement and by challenge. It is an era which calls for action and for the best efforts of all those who would test the unknown and the uncertain in every phase of human endeavor. It is a time for pathfinders and pioneers. I have come to Texas today to salute an outstanding group of pioneers, the men who manned the Brooks Air Force Base School of Aerospace Medicine and the Aerospace Medical Center. It is fitting that San Antonio should be the site of this center and this school as we gather to dedicate this complex of buildings. For this city has long been the home of the pioneers in the air. It was here that Sidney Brooks, whose memory we honor today, was born and raised. It was here that Charles Lindbergh and Claire Chennault and a host of others who in World War I and World War II and Korea and even today have helped demonstrate American mastery of the skies, trained at Kelly Field and Randolph Field, which form a major part of aviation history. And in the new frontier of outer space, while headlines may be made by others in other places, history is being made every day by the men and women of the Aerospace Medical Center, without whom there could be no history. Many Americans make the mistake of assuming that space research has no values here on Earth. Nothing could be further from the truth. Just as the wartime development of radar gave us the transistor and all that it made possible, so research in space medicine holds the promise of substantial benefit to those of us who are earthbound. For our effort in space is not, as some have suggested, a competitor for the natural resources that we need to develop the Earth. It is a working partner and a co-producer of these resources. And nothing makes this clearer than the fact that medicine in space is going to make our lives healthier and happier here on Earth. I give you three examples. First, medical space research may open up new understanding of man's relation to his environment. Examination of the astronauts' physical and mental and emotional reactions can teach us more about the differences between normal and abnormal, about the causes and effects of disorientation in metabolism, which could result in extending the lifespan. When you study effects on our astronauts of exhaust gases, which can contaminate their environment, and seek ways to alter these gases so to reduce their toxicity, you are working on problems similar to those we face in our great urban centers, which themselves are being corrupted by gases and which must be cleared. And second, medical space research may revolutionize the technology and the techniques of modern medicine. Whatever new devices are created, for example, to monitor our astronauts, to measure their heart activity, their breathing, their brain waves, their eye motion, at great distances and under difficult conditions, will also represent a major advance in general medical instrumentation. Heart patients may even be able to wear a light monitor, which will sound a warning if their activity exceeds certain limits. An instrument recently developed to record automatically the impact of acceleration upon an astronaut's eyes will also be of help to small children who are suffering miserably from eye defects but are unable to describe their impairment, and also by the use of instruments similar to those used in Project Mercury, this nation's private as well as public nursing services are being improved, enabling one nurse now to give more critically ill patients greater attention than they ever could in the past. And third, medical space research may lead to new safeguards against hazards common to many environments. Specifically, our astronauts will need fundamentally new devices to protect them from the ill effects of radiation, which can have a profound influence upon medicine and man's relations to our present environment. Here at this center, we have the laboratories, the talent, the resources to give new impetus to vital research in the life centers. I'm not suggesting that the entire space program is justified alone by what is done in medicine. The space program stands on its own as a contribution to national strength. And last Saturday at Cape Canaveral, I saw our new Saturn C-1 rocket booster, which with its payload, when it rises in December of this year, will be, for the first time, the largest booster in the world, carrying into space the largest payload that any country in the world has ever sent into space. That's what I consider. I think the United States should be a leader. A country as rich and powerful as this, which bears so many burdens and responsibilities, which has so many opportunities, should be second to none. And in December, while I do not regard our mastery of space as anywhere near complete, while I recognize that there are still areas where we are behind, at least in one area, the size of the booster, this year I hope the United States will be ahead. And I'm for it. We have a long way to go, many weeks and months and years of long, tedious work lies ahead. There will be setbacks and frustrations and disappointments. There will be, as there always are, pressures on this country to do less in this area as in so many others, and temptations to do something else that's perhaps easier. But this research here must go on. This space effort must go on. The conquest of space must and will go ahead. That much we know. That much we can say with confidence and conviction. Frank O'Connor, the Irish writer, tells in one of his books how, as a boy, he and his friends would make their way across the countryside. And when they came to an orchard wall that seemed too high and too doubtful to try, and too difficult to permit their voyage to continue, they took off their hats and tossed them over the wall, and then they had no choice but to follow them. This nation has tossed its cap over the wall of space, and we have no choice but to follow it. Whatever the difficulties, they will be overcome. Whatever the hazards, they must be guarded against. With the vital help of this Aerospace Medical Center, with the help of all those who labor in the space endeavor, with the help and support of all Americans, we will climb this wall with safety and with speed, and we shall then explore the wonders on the other side. Thank you.
President Kennedy speaking the day before he was assassinated in Dallas on 1963, November the 22nd. And we have more about Kennedy and his space speeches after these messages.
Hi, I'm Peter Mitchell. Join us right throughout September for the 15th annual Very Special Kids Piggy Bank Appeal to support families of children with life-threatening illnesses. You can make a donation, purchase merchandise, or run your own fundraiser. To find out more, go to vsk.org.au. Come on, Victoria. Please feed the piggy banks and help raise over $1 million for the Very Special Kids Piggy Bank Appeal, because together we can make a difference.
This man is working hard to help the homeless. In fact, his whole family are. They're sleeping out of their beds to help provide basic shelter to the homeless. You can help too. Register at swagtember.com.au and sleep out or hold an event. There are prizes to the value of over $4,000 up for grabs. Register at swagtember.com.au today.
You're listening to The Space Show on 88.3 Southern FM, and tonight we have a special marking the 50th anniversary of the To the Moon speech, which was given by President Kennedy at Rice University in Texas. Now, it is clear that by the time of his death, Kennedy was having serious misgivings about the man on the moon effort and waning public support. He was even having tentative talks about cooperating with the Soviet Union in manned spaceflight, and discussed this with NASA Administrator James Webb in 1963 September. One of the reasons he went down to Texas in November 1963 was to shore up support for the Democrats there. And he made two speeches. He made a very important speech about the process. We heard one of them. But then he went on into Dallas, and he was to deliver a speech at the Trade Mart in Dallas less than an hour after he was actually assassinated. He was only about less than 5 to 10 minutes away from the Trade Mart when he was killed. And but we have the text of that speech, and we've taken out the part of it that relates to space travel. And Peter Arwood from the Space Association of Australia is going to be reading it for us.
I have spoken of strength largely in terms of the deterrence and resistance of aggression and attack. And it is also why we have regained the initiative in the exploration of outer space, making an annual effort greater than the combined total of all space activities undertaken during the 50s, launching more than 130 vehicles into Earth orbit, putting into actual operation valuable weather and communications satellites, and making it clear to all that the United States of America has no intention of finishing second in space. This effort is expensive, but it pays its own way for freedom and for America. For there is no longer any fear in the free world that a communist lead in space will become a permanent assertion of supremacy and the basis of military superiority. There is no longer any doubt about the strength and skill of American science, American industry, American education, and American free enterprise system. In short, our national space effort represents a great gain in and a great resource of our national strength, and both Texas and Texans are contributing greatly to this strength.
After giving that speech, Kennedy would have returned to the airport and flown to Austin in Texas, where he was to address the Texas Democratic State Committee. Once again, Peter Arwood is going to read a part of the speech that he would have delivered there.
In the last 3 years, we have increased our annual space effort to a greater level than the combined total of all space activities undertaken in the 50s. We have launched into Earth orbit more than four times as many space vehicles as had been launched in the previous 3 years. We have focused our wide-ranging efforts around a landing on the moon in this decade. We have put valuable weather and communications satellites into actual operation. We will fire this December the most powerful rocket ever developed anywhere in the world, and we have made it clear to all that the United States of America has no intention of finishing second in outer space. Texas will play a major role in this effort. The Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston will be the cornerstone of our lunar landing project, with $1 billion already allocated to that center this year. Even though space is an infant industry, more than 3,000 people are already employed in space activities here in Texas. More than $100 million of space contracts are now being worked on in this state, and more than 50 space-related firms have announced the opening of Texas offices. This is still a daring and dangerous frontier, and there are those who would prefer to turn back or take a more timid stance. But Texans have stood their ground on embattled frontiers before, and I know you will help us to see this battle through.
And that was read there by Peter Iwood. Following the assassination, Lyndon Johnson assumed the presidency. Although becoming increasingly mired in Vietnam and domestic unrest, Johnson continued to support the Apollo project. By the time of the first moon landing in 1969 July, there was the Republican Richard Nixon in the White House. It was he who made that phone call to Neil and Buzz on the moon. Most of those listening around the world were wishing it could have been Jack Kennedy doing the honors, and for Jack to have been there to welcome the crew back to Earth. Well, to mark this 50th anniversary of Kennedy's To the Moon speech, Alan Shepard's Freedom 7 capsule is being put on display at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum in Boston. The one-ton capsule will remain there for 3 years until 2015 December. It will then move to the Air and Space Museum in Washington, and there it will form part of a display that will tell how the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo projects went from nothing to the moon in only 14 years. From 1998 to a few days ago, Freedom 7 was on display at the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. Before that, it was at the National Air and Space Museum, which is where I saw it in 1980. This program was researched, written, and presented by Andrew Rennie, with readings by Peter Aylward.